Coming up, Tom Haverstraw and I are talking about Kevin Durant's delusional comments about the Sixers and Warriors, the Dylan Brooks extension, 80 in the Wizards, and then we continue my entertainment rankings on the Bucks and the Kings. And then after that, I'm bringing on Adam Gold, who's covered the Carolina Hurricanes the entire time Tom Dundon has owned the team. And we talk about what does Dundon's choices in Carolina mean for the future of the Portland Trailblazers? All that's coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're going to talk about the NBA offseason today, and joining me to do it, Tom Haverstraw. Tom, what's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. Voice is back. Happy to report. They call you KOC in the streets. We're calling me RFK, Kev, because my voice was, it was shot last couple of days.
Oh, my God. I mean, dude, as bad as your voice sounded on the big number yesterday, not quite RFK. not quite RFK. Not quite there. Kevin Durant, he was in the news this week. This is the point of the NBA offseason where we're going to talk about nonsense like this. Because Kevin Durant, I'm not sure if he's trolling or just downright delusional when he commented on a post comparing LeBron James joining the Sixers to him joining the Warriors when he said, ain't close. Laughing my ass off. Joel, MVP recently. Jaylen Brown, recent finals MVP. Tyrese Maxey, all-star the last 3 years. We all know what LeBron does. Klay Thompson was never an MVP candidate and nothing. 22 points per game. Draymond Green, 14 points per game. 7 boards, 6 assists. Steph, an MVP, just like Joel was. I don't get how the Warriors team is better on paper. KD, Tom, like I said, is he trolling? Or is he delusional still about his decision to leave a team that blew a 3-1 lead in the Western Conference Finals to join a 73-9 Golden State Warriors team to win 2 NBA Finals, 2 Finals MVPs, but people devalue it considering the team that he went to that was already a perennial contender, that was a 73-win team that was in the NBA Finals and beat your team? Is he delusional about that? Or is he just trolling? I don't know the answer, Tom. What do you think it is? Is he trolling?
I think he's delusional on this. It doesn't seem like he's trolling, considering the multiple times that he's had opportunities to kind of clear the air about what he actually means here. I mean, Joel Embiid, yes, he won an MVP, but I wouldn't characterize that as recent. It was in the 2023 season, which 4 years before the upcoming season, Steph Curry was coming off 2 MVP seasons. The Warriors were coming off a 73-win season. And I just don't think you can claim that Jaylen Brown winning a finals MVP is on par with some of the accolades that Warriors team was. It's just, I don't know. 3 years in the NBA is like a decade in basketball terms. Just because you can say that Joel Embiid won an MVP in 2023 does not put him on par with peak Steph Curry in 2016. It just doesn't add up, especially when you consider the miles on the tires of Joel Embiid at now compared to where Steph was in 2016. It's delusional, and that's okay. Like, I understand why he's pointing to that Warriors team, because he feels a certain way, I'm guessing, about how everyone, the media piled on to him joining a super team that had broken the Chicago Bulls record, and everyone just destroyed KD for doing that. And I think he's trying to draw the parallel that on paper, quote unquote, the 76ers have a much stronger resume. But when you stack them next to each other, the resume is, outside of like all-stars, recent all-stars, the resume for the Warriors was much better than this 76ers team. If you take out LeBron for this 76ers team and you take out KD from that 2016, 2015, 2014 Warriors, the 76ers had 8 all-star appearances when you talk about Jaylen Brown, Embiid, and Tyrese Maxey. They had 8 combined in the previous 4 seasons. But then if you look at all NBA awards, the Warriors team with Klay, Draymond, and Steph had 6 All-NBA, 2 MVPs in Steph Curry, and a Finals MVP in Andre Iguodala in that 2015 season. So if you want to throw in Jaylen Brown winning a Finals MVP 2 years ago, you have to throw in that KD was joining an Andre Iguodala team that he won a Finals MVP. He didn't mention that in his breakdown, but I think it's relevant. And even if you look at the previous season, as in what the 76ers had coming into this year. They had three All-Stars last year, two All-NBA players, but no MVP, no Finals MVP, whereas the Warriors were stacked on that comparison too. So I also point out Tyrese Maxey has not been an All-Star in the last three seasons. He mentioned that in his breakdown. Two out of the last three seasons, Tyrese Maxey. But to me, this all points to him trying to lower the volume on all the hate he got for joining the Warriors in 2016. And it just seems to me that he still feels a lot of, it's just something that he feels a little resentful over the media and what how they treated him in 2016. But this is not equals what we're seeing from the 76ers this year and to the KD when he joined the Warriors.
He has nobody to blame but himself, Tom. It was a mistake at the time, in my opinion, to go to Golden State. I know he won two finals. I know he won two finals MVPs. I know he played the best basketball of his career. KD playing the five for certain stretches was just unbelievable with those Warriors teams. Like, he was absolutely transcendent on the floor. It was the best decision and the worst decision of his entire career to join the Golden State Warriors, because it's always going to follow him. When you left a team that blew a 3-1 lead to your opponent and you join that opponent, you leave the Thunder and you leave the Warriors. How could you not know in the moment that it was going to lead to conversation like this about your career and your decision-making, especially given the fact that he's won nothing other than those years with Golden State? And so, yeah, I'm sure he does feel a certain way about it, and he's trying to do everything in his mind to equate LeBron joining the Sixers to joining the Warriors. It's just stupid. It really is. It just straight up is stupid. This Sixers team has won nothing. They haven't even gotten out of the second round. Joel Embiid is the type of player who, forget about the MVP, forget about it, forget about the injuries, look purely at the playoff production. People look at Joel Embiid and they view him as somebody that folds in the postseason, that his style of play doesn't translate to the postseason. Those Warriors teams were already champions. They already were proven. The Sixers have proven nothing. Jaylen Brown individually did, but Tyrese Maxey has gotten through the second round. Joel Embiid hasn't. This team is just jumbled together. It's a newly formed team, and I don't know what they're going to look like. And by the way, KD joined the Golden State Warriors in the prime of his career. LeBron is 42 next year. So it's just absolutely silly, and rightfully so. Klay Thompson responded on Instagram, his story, saying, "Why are you using my full government name? You know, what do you have against me?" Draymond Green went on his podcast, and I thought his comments were very interesting. Draymond said, "You have to understand the way KD views basketball. It's very Uncle Drew-ish. The game will always be about buckets." So he's going to mention 25 point per game scorers. He also said the Sixers are better on paper than the Warriors because of the scorers they have on their team. I think that sums up a lot with what Draymond is saying. Draymond obviously knows KD better than any of us can, given the time they've spent together, the debates they had in the locker room that we'll never see the light of day, the deep conversations about basketball they've had that we will never understand. Clearly, Draymond has an understanding about how KD views the game, and that's about getting buckets above all else. And so maybe KD, maybe it's even less delusional and more just a delusioned perspective about the game of basketball and what leads to winning. Maybe it's more so that. Maybe it's more a reflection of the way in which he's played his career as a score first, score second, score third, then be a playmaker type of player. And that's not to diminish who he is. He's one of the greatest scorers ever, and he leaned into what makes him great. He also is a solid playmaker, but not a great one, and a very good defender at his peak. But I do think it says a lot about KD and some of his flaws as a player, if Draymond is indeed right about viewing it this way. But it's just so silly to me.
Well, Kev, this does explain a lot. I think it's very convenient that KD is using the Warriors as the comp for the 76ers team in light of Draymond Green's comments about, hey, he really views the game as points per game, scoring. How many buckets can you get? When you could argue that KD could have pointed to two other teams that he joined, or at least super teams since the Warriors. Why didn't he mention the Nets team with Kyrie and with James Harden and how many scores they had and the scary hours? Why didn't he point to that? Because that flamed out. It was obviously not a good experiment, what happened with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. But if we do want to do apples to apples about 25-point scores or 20-point scores stacking on the same team, again, this is what KD was saying, is that they had four 20-point scores, three 25-point scores, the 76ers, Brown averaging 29 last year, Maxey averaging 28 last year, Embiid averaging 26, LeBron averaging 20. But let's not forget that Harden team, when he joined the Brooklyn Nets, they had three 25-point scores. Harden was coming off a full season with Houston, in which he averaged 33 points per game. And then he joined that Nets team and it flamed out. They did not get out of the set. They did not get to the conference finals in the 2 years they had it going. And I would also point to the Phoenix Suns. We all forget about the Bradley Beal acquisition, but Bradley Beal was the same age that Jaylen Brown is now, joining from the Washington Wizards, in which he averaged 23 points a game. And so when you look at the Phoenix Suns experiment with Bradley Beal and the huge scores that they had on that team with Devin Booker and KD, and they flamed out, I think it's pretty clear that the way that KD views the game in stacking guys who can get buckets is not optimal. And if you're gonna disagree with LeBron James's abilities as a GM, I would also point to the fact that KD as a GM and the teams that he likes to build around himself and all the different coaches that he's had over the last 6 years, you can point to the common denominator there is Kevin Durant. While he does love scores on his team, they do not perform above expectations and get more out of each other. And in fact, it's the opposite when it comes to Kevin Durant's teams, who I think over the last 5 years, his teams have underperformed Vegas projections in each of those 5 years. And so you got to point to the fact that Kevin Durant, while he's one of the best scorers of all time, one of the greatest players of all time, I just think he misses the mark on all of these conversations with regard to the 2016 Warriors and the 2016 Warriors and the 2017 76ers.
Well, since Kevin Durant left Golden State, 2021 Nets lost in the second round, 2022 Nets lost in the first round, 2023 Suns lost in the second round, 2024 Suns lost in the first round, 2025 Suns missed the playoffs, 2026 Houston Rockets lose in the first round to LeBron James, and that's it. No Austin Reeves, no Luka Doncic. They lose to old man LeBron James against Kevin Durant. Granted, he didn't play much in that series for the Houston Rockets. He was out injured as well, unfortunately. So I think for Kevin Durant, I hope this Houston season goes better for him than last year's did with his first full year with the Houston Rockets. But I'm not totally optimistic there about them being an actual championship team with how that team is built and their flaws. The Warriors also, obviously, they're not in a great spot now either. There was reporting this week from Nick Friedell that Steve Kerr, Draymond Green, and Stephen Curry acknowledged that they're no longer contenders. And that does seem to be the case, that they don't have a shot unless they're willing to move Jimmy Butler in their future picks. And as we've talked about all summer, they seem unwilling to do that. They did bring back Draymond Green, though, after losing out on LeBron James. We talked last week about him going back on the one-year, $27 million deal. He talked on his podcast about his decision to not fight for a no-trade clause, and he felt like it just wasn't worth it. And he said, quote, "I think if the Warriors want to trade me at some point in the season, they want to trade me. I've never been a guy who wants to stay somewhere I'm not wanted." And obviously, back in January and February, the Warriors were shopping Draymond Green, not Jimmy Butler, out with a torn ACL, for Giannis Antetokounmpo. That didn't work out, of course. Giannis ends up in Miami this summer. But Draymond Green was open at the time about that as well. And he said effectively the same thing in February on the Draymond Green show. "I don't want to be somewhere where they don't want me." And so I think with Draymond, he acknowledges the possibility that Golden State could look to trade him this season to another team. And I think from Draymond's perspective, this is something for us as media and as fans to think about this entire year when it comes to what players might be available for trade that could help bolster contenders. Put Draymond Green on that list of players that could be available as a defensive piece, as a connecting playmaker who could be available, whether it's the Warriors trading him away for parts, like draft picks, young players, or whether it's the Warriors trading him away with pieces to bring in somebody else. And so I think that puts Draymond Green on the big lump of players who could be available directly in a trade to a contender, or goes to a rebuilding team and he gets bought out and then he signs wherever he wants to, and he still gets paid the money that he did this year, $27 million. So I'm just putting that on our radars right now, Tom, as a potential story to track over the course of the season of Draymond Green's availability.
Yeah, the two teams that are most interesting to me for Draymond, given that he is okay with waiving his no trade clause and is already making comments about maybe the Warriors want to trade me in the midseason, and I want to help facilitate that if they feel that way. Two teams I'm looking at is Detroit Pistons after they traded Beef Stew to the Memphis Grizzlies. I'm looking at a homecoming for Draymond Green, a Michigan State guy from Michigan. I could see something where the Pistons look at their roster without Beef Stew and looking for an edge, looking for a guy with championship experience to try to get them over the hump in the postseason and not just be another 55-50 win team that can't make it deep into the postseason. Don't think Draymond solves all of their issues, especially as a shot creator down the stretch next to Cade Cunningham, but he does fill certain positional roles for the Pistons, especially with his championship mentality. And he's going to be a big personality in that locker room. They lose Beef Stew, who's kind of the enforcer on that team. I could see them using Draymond Green as a rental and someone to get a veteran presence for that roster. Secondly, we saw what the Phoenix Suns did this offseason, bringing in Miles Bridges, a Michigan State guy. And we've cracked jokes about up and down the roster and in the front office, all the way from the ownership down. They're all Spartans. They're all Michigan State guys littered on this roster, both on the floor and off the floor. And so if you're the Phoenix Suns looking at trying to make a push in the postseason, is it possible that they decide to upgrade their veteran presence with Draymond Green? Of course, it all comes down to how Draymond's playing, how healthy he is, and on top of that, what the Golden State Warriors might be looking for in such a deal, or if they have to attach assets into a deal to make that worthwhile for the incumbent or the next team. But those two teams I'm circling and watching as we go into next season, the Detroit Pistons and the Phoenix Suns, both with aspirations to go deep into the playoffs beyond what they did this past year.
I would add another team, and it's very coincidental that they have a traded player exception that is equal to Draymond Green's salary at $27,678,571. And that team is the Boston Celtics. Their traded player exception is equal to that amount of money that Draymond Green is making. And so I'd add Boston to that list of teams in terms of who might have interest in trading directly for Draymond Green. I think Charlotte is interesting too. Like, if Charlotte's good, like, what if they're a top four seed, top five seed in the East, and they're like, let's go for it. Let's go. You know, two-man action with Kobe White and Draymond and Con Knipple and Draymond Green, add them to the bunch. I could see Charlotte. I could see Boston. I could see a number of teams, especially if it led to a buyout. But I think in terms of trades, Charlotte and Boston with their traded player exceptions, especially Boston. I mean, it is kind of funny. It's literally equal, Tom, right? It's equal for Draymond's salary.
Well, we saw that with the James Harden contract and Darius Garland and that swap, is that sometimes these contracts and the number on those contracts, you got to keep your third eye open on why that number in particular is agreed upon on both sides. But with the Boston Celtics, you know, I have big expectations on the Celtics this year. I think they're going to win the East. Yesterday in the big number pod, we picked our three favorite overs, three favorite unders going into next year. And a lot can change, obviously, between now and training camp and the start of the season. But if Draymond goes to the Boston Celtics, you have another veteran with replacing Al Horford. And maybe Al Horford comes along too. We'll see what happens with the Celtics. But man, they got a lot of good players. And trading Jaylen Brown to the 76ers and getting back Paul George, I think the Boston Celtics are going to be really good next year. And as the dust has settled, I think people are coming around to the idea that the Celtics might be a lot better than expected. And Draymond Green certainly would add a lot more edge to that team. And it's just a matter of whether Joe Mazzulla and Draymond Green, in terms of like guys who are hardwired to win championships and do everything they can to win, super competitive. I would love to watch those two minds playing together in Boston. So we'll see. That trade exception, very, very sneaky, interesting.
for what it's worth, for Celtics fans yelling at their phones or their computers right now, I know the Celtics, with their traded player exception, would have to give up some salary because of the first apron that they're capped at. So that's enough of Draymond Green, Kevin Durant, and the Warriors. Dylan Brooks, he signed a 3-year, $73 million extension with the Phoenix Suns. Kind of funny to me, Tom, that Brooks signs this extension while all these guys are just waiting in restricted free agency right now. Jalen Duren, Peyton Watson still floating out there. Kuminga's not a restricted free agent, but he's still unsigned. And meanwhile, Dylan Brooks, hard-nosed, defensive-oriented player, winning mentality, gets rewarded with 3 years, $73 million by the Phoenix Suns. And Brooks is a guy that I've been wrong about plenty in recent years. One of the things I've been most wrong about is Dylan Brooks. When he was in Memphis, I said I wouldn't want him for the league minimum because of how bad things were for him at the end of his Grizzlies tenure. Yeah, $73 million over 3 years at this point. Pretty good value, I'll say that at this point.
Yeah, a little bit more than the minimum, I would say, on that one. Well, I think for Dylan Brooks, look, man, talk about like a contract year, averaging 20 points a game for a team that needed a lot of that scoring help. Jalen Green in and out of the lineup, not someone that everyone expected to be one of the top, you know, scorers in the league, Dylan Brooks. And I mean, I think for me, Dylan Brooks as a locker room guy, as a leader, and this is the kind of lunch pail, blue collar culture that they wanted to establish in Phoenix. And he certainly delivered that in a big way. My question is, you know, was that a 1 year blip? And as he ages into his 30s, how much can they expect to get him on that offensive end? And really, I think what's most interesting about this Phoenix Suns team as they build around Devin Booker is getting Devin Booker back to being an elite player in a league. Took a step back last year, and Dylan Brooks's rise, I'm not saying it came at the cost of Devin Booker, but all these, you know, the continuity stuff with Colin Gillespie coming back, with Dylan Brooks being signed to this extension, kind of dances around the issue that unless Devin Booker gets back to being a top 10 player in the league, I don't really see this Phoenix Suns team contending for titles anytime soon. So it is nice that they brought back Dylan Brooks, but when you see Devin Booker becoming less efficient, especially getting to the cup where he 2 years ago was shooting 76% from the floor around the basket area, and now it's around 67%. Not as efficient, getting to the line more, but if he's not able to be more athletic around the basket and finishing at a high level, it caps Devin Booker's ceiling and therefore caps the Phoenix Suns ceiling. So it is nice work here getting Dylan Brooks on an extension, but I want to see more out of Devin Booker before I get too excited about an extension around him.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Tom. Devin Booker, especially at the money that he's going to be making with this upcoming extension, is just pretty crazy, the money Devin Booker is going to be making, nearly $70 million on the final year of that contract. And he's going to be better, closer to what we saw when the Suns made their finals run. Anthony Davis and the Wizards were in the news this morning. Josh Robbins at The Athletic wrote a story where he reported that AD and the Wizards are not expected to discuss an extension. And that's because today is August 6th. That's the date where he's eligible to sign a 4 or 5 year, $280 million extension with Washington. And Robbins wrote, "The decision to hold off on substantive talks until the season could stem in part from both parties needing to learn more about each other. Questions that perhaps can only be answered after Davis and the team have played a large enough sample size of regular season games." And so I think this is likely spot on. I think from Washington's perspective, they gave Trae Young the money because they think Trae Young's injury issues last year were a blip, and they feel confident about him moving forward and being a guy who can help elevate this franchise. Anthony Davis, they don't feel that level of confidence that his long history of injuries are going to go away. AD saying he's going to play 82 games this year. You know, I'll see it when I'll believe it when I see it, when we actually see that happen. AD, and also AD, you look back at his comments back in April after the season, and he said, "Well, I want to see the plan for this team. It's really hard for a team to go from winning less than 20 games to being a contender, and I want to contend at this stage of my career." And so all July, I reported about the potential of LeBron James waiting to see how the AD situation played out. Clearly, he didn't need to wait until August for it to play out. He decided to go to the Philadelphia 76ers. But I do think with AD, there is an element of, and this is more further evidence of that, that this team isn't locked in together. AD with Anthony Davis, AD with the Washington Wizards. And now we're at a point where with Washington, maybe he is on the trade block midseason because they're just middling and he wants to go elsewhere. Teams are going after him. There's good offers on the table. Or maybe he's excellent and the Wizards are exceeding expectations and he decides he wants to stay at a non-full max number. And that the Wizards with Trae Young and AD and AJ DiBanza and all their young guys getting better, suddenly maybe they're a top six seed in the East. I would not rule that out. It's a non-zero chance that Washington is way better than people expect if AD and Trae Young are healthy and if the young guys get better. And so I think that framing by Josh Robbins is likely very much informed by his conversations with both the AD camp and especially with the Washington Wizards front office side of things, that they just want more time together to see how things look. And that's going to dictate what amount of money they're willing to agree to on both sides, but also whether AD is actually going to be there long term.
Yeah, to me, this is just spin from AD's camp. You know, the fact that the Washington Wizards were not willing or don't seem to be willing to get into extension costs and offer him a big extension just reminds me of like getting rejected by a girl and then being like, yeah, I wasn't interested anyway. I wasn't really all that into her anyway. Wanted to see how things were going before I committed. That kind of feels like what's going on here is that once they gave money to Trae Young, I think Rich Paul, Clutch Sports, they probably saw the writing on the wall is that they're not going to be willing to commit to both Trae Young and AD at max or near max money. And so at that point, he can say, look, I want to kind of feel things out too. I'm not really sure if I want to commit long-term here. AD wants his money. He's turning 35.
It's a situationship. That's what they're in.
Yeah, a situationship. Exactly. Where I feel like AD, he knows that he's turning 35 next year, 34 next year. It's not going to be an opportunity.
He's hitting the wall.
He wants to get his money, and if the Wizards were not willing to offer him the money, I think he's got to spin it in the best way possible. And I think it caught him off guard that he was going to get traded to the Wizards. And so he's still in a state of shock about how his career went from, I'm with LeBron, we're chasing championships every year, and then got traded for Luka and then got shipped over to Washington. It feels like AD's in a little bit of a career twilight zone where he doesn't know which way is up anymore. And so once they gave the money to Trae Young at the number that they were, I could see that AD is like, yo, I saw that and I know that I'm probably not long for the Washington Wizards. I'm still confused about the Wizards' trajectory going forward. And that's a big reason why I took them as a hard under on, I think there were 35 and a half wins for next year, which is more than double of how many wins they had last year. Upcoming season is, I think it's at 35. I may be wrong about that. Yeah, 35 and a half. That means they have to double last year's wins with Trae Young and AD being the most injury riddled super stars in the league. I don't see it. And I understand why AD is trying to push the narrative that he wasn't really sure about if he wants to extend in Washington. But to me, that's just spin.
Well, we'll see if Anthony Davis can looks max his way to, I don't know, 70-something games this year. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. What is that what the kids say these days? Looks maxing? What is sure. It? Looks maxing? Yeah, something like that? I don't know. Is sure. It even kids who say that, or is that just like online?
No, yes, you know, yes, of course. People?
Who's that? Who's the guy, the influencer? Clavicler or something like that? I don't know. I have no idea.
Nope. Asking the wrong guy on that one.
How old are your kids, Tom?
Not old enough to know who that is.
Thank goodness. And we'll be right back after this break. Let's move on to my entertainment rankings here, starting with number 29. I talked about the Brooklyn Nets at number 30 in my NBA entertainment rankings on Monday's podcast. A lot of Nets fans were like, are you serious? Yeah, I'm serious. The Nets are not that interesting. I mean, where do you expect them to be? 26, 27? They're still in the bottom tier. And the next team in the bottom tier is the Milwaukee Bucks. They, of course, this offseason lose Giannis Antetokounmpo. They trade him to the Miami Heat for Tyler Hero, Hamet Kakes, Khalil Ware, Kasperis Jakachonis, picks. They also pick up Caris LeVert in the draft. They get Braden Burries, who was awesome, awesome for the Bucks in summer league. Nate Ament, who had his moments as well. They signed Markovic, his draft rights, bringing him over as well. They lose Giannis, and all the Antetokounmpos, Alex and Thanasis, are gone. And you look at the roster, Tom, with the depth chart on the Bucks, they have 17 guys right now. They have to make some cuts or trades before the season. But it's amazing how much depth the Bucks look like they have when there's not three Antetokounmpos on the team anymore, with Alex and Thanasis just taking up roster spots. The Bucks have a lot of good players. Miles Turner, Jericho Sims, Khalil Ware, the bigs, forwards, Jaime Jaquez, Kyle Kuzma, Nate Ament, Tyler Hero, AJ Green, Kevin Porter, Gary Trent, Caris LeVert, Ryan Rollins, Braden Burries, Kasperis Jakachonis. That's a lot of like solid players, but the team's not good. It's not a good team, but it's a lot of solid players. Am I underrating the Bucks, Tom? Is it possible this team exceeds expectations this year?
Yeah, I actually think they're a good bet to be the over on 26.5 wins. They're projected by BetMGM as the third worst team in the NBA. Taylor Jenkins is a good coach, and I think there's a lot of good guard talent on this roster, especially when you add in Miles Turner as a spacer, and he's going to be wanting to play for a contender. So I expect him to try to ball out in the early season and maybe look for a trade. This Tyler Hero backcourt, along with Burries, AJ Green, you got Derry Bird there, who's an excellent shooter. They got a bunch of good young talent. Ryan Rollins, a sneaky good player for them last year at the point guard position, most improved player of the year for much of the year. And I just don't know where they're going to find minutes for all these good guards. And that's a good problem to have for Taylor Jenkins. They're not really, they don't have a surplus of good wing forwards on the roster, but man, I could see this team winning 30, 35 games if everything turns out where Taylor Jenkins figures out how they all complement each other. Because Jaquez, Hero, Rollins, they got a lot of good shooters in here with AJ Green. Kevin Porter Jr., also underrated last season, off-court issues in his career for sure, and the injury last year kind of downgrading him. But there's a lot of good players and a lot of good scorers on this team. It's just whether they can defend at a high level in order for them to be kind of low-key watchable next year. So are they the 29th slot? Maybe a little bit higher than that in my book, but I think they're a pretty solid bet to finish with over 26.5 wins next year, just because I think the coach and the low-key talent under here, they don't have any incentive to tank next year. They don't control their pick. So I could see them winning 30 to 35 wins next year. You don't have to squint to do that.
Like you said, they have no incentive to lose. Zero. They don't have their pick. The Pelicans are going to get that pick. And so for the Bucks, I think it's going to be very intriguing to see the way they play things this year. And when you think of reasons to watch the Bucks, I think you hit on that one, Tom. When it comes to the amount of good talent, upgrading from Doc Rivers to Taylor Jenkins, this team should be trying to compete. I'm curious about the guys they got from Miami. Do any of these ex-Heat players blossom? Do any of these guys, like Khalil Ware, Eric Spoelstra had him on a really short leash for a long time in Miami, where he had these moments where he looked like a potential star, but he had these moments where he looked like a dud. What version of Khalil Ware do we get? Jaquez, after he was in contention for Sixth Man of the Year last year, does he get starter minutes? Does he take a leap forward? Does a young guy like Kasperis Jakachonis look like the perfect backcourt partner next to Braden Burries for the long term? What happens with these ex-Miami players? Never mind Tyler Hero as the biggest name of that group, but I wonder if any of these Miami Heat players end up popping and exceeding all expectations.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Khalil Ware, he was kind of a guy that would fill the box score, but in terms of being a defensive anchor for the Miami Heat, wasn't able to do that or get enough of that confidence from Eric Spoelstra. But in a different organization where he's not having to share the floor with Bam Adebayo, he might look a little bit different. Look, I think the haul they got for Giannis Antetokounmpo, it depends on whether Tyler Hero is an empty calorie scorer or whether he is a legit engine of a good offense. And so we'll see. Jaime Jaquez Jr. is probably going to step up into a starting role this season and not just be the sixth man of the year. But there's a lot to be excited about if you're a Milwaukee Bucks fan trying to turn the page with the hometown Tyler Hero coming into the picture. But he's going to be looking for a new contract. Miles Turner's going to probably be looking to win games at, you know, as he enters his mid-30s here in his career. I think you're going to see this team be one of the – there's a lot of outcomes on the table for the Milwaukee Bucks, but being a 26-win team, to me, doesn't feel like that's in the cards, especially because they have no incentive to lose.
Scott of Gray Water Watch in the live YouTube chat said, KOC, the Bucks can be better than the Heat. I wouldn't go that far. I think Miami is going to have an elite defense with Bam Adebayo, even in the minutes without Giannis on the floor. That team has the chance to be an elite defense with Davion Mitchell at the point of attack, Andrew Wiggins on the wing, Bam Adebayo. The team could be sensational. And then Giannis gives you such a high floor on as an offense, at least in the top half of the NBA, despite their lack of shooting. And so, look, I would not rule out, as Tom said, 30 to 35 wins for the Bucks, but and I wouldn't rule out the Miami Heat having injury issues, and they are under 500. I would not rule that out, but the Heat are going to be better than the Milwaukee Bucks for sure. It would be such a shocker otherwise. And I think the other side for the Bucks, though, Tom, is that this roster isn't complete. Like I said earlier, there's 17 guys currently under contract. They need to make roster changes. And so other thought on my mind, and this is kind of an off-season thought, but also an in-season thought, what moves are the Bucks going to make? Because they have so many guys on this team, even after they get down to 15. Like, somebody's going to be getting no minutes. Kevin Porter is going to be getting no minutes possibly. Gary Trent, despite the big contract he got, might not be getting minutes every night. Caris LeVert, these veterans. And so this starts in the summer. What are the Bucks going to do to get to 15? And Eric Neem over at The Athletic, who covers the Milwaukee Bucks, wrote about today how the Bucks still want Peyton Watson, but he said they're hesitant to include a first-round draft pick in those trade talks with the Denver Nuggets and what would have to be a sign-and-trade to bring in Peyton Watson from Denver. Denver is in the very interesting position, as we've talked about, where they're over the second apron. They cannot bring back players in a sign-and-trade involving Peyton Watson because they're over the second apron. They also just signed Lonnie Walker this week to another contract, so they need to make further moves to get under the second apron. They also need to get under the second apron if they want to sign-and-trade Peyton Watson elsewhere. I do think Milwaukee is very, very interesting for Watson, Tom, for a couple of reasons. Reason number one, they have a $24.3 million traded player exception from the Giannis deal. So they don't need to give up that much in salary in order to bring in Peyton Watson for a $24-ish million contract. And they could give up Hawkins. They could give up, I don't know, Kasparis Yakachonis. They could give up Kuzma. Like, actually, Kuzma wouldn't work financially because of the Bucks. The Nuggets could only take back $12, $13 million or so. But point being, they have to cut roster spots. They could give up Hawkins and Kevin Porter to the Nuggets and get Caris LeVert. Something like that I could see having appeal. But Hawkins and those Heat players, Caris LeVert, guys like that, can't be aggregated in deals until September 6th. And so I think there could be something here with Milwaukee and Denver that's worth keeping in mind with this Bucks team possibly being incomplete.
Yeah, if I'm the Nuggets, I want AJ Green. I want a guy that can space the floor. And you put AJ Green next to Jokic, good luck having to choose between, you know, those poison pills of doubling up on Jokic, and then you free up one of the best shooters in the league, and he's on a great contract. So if I'm the Denver Nuggets, that's the guy I'm targeting. I think that might be too frothy. If I'm looking at the Milwaukee Bucks, do I give up Hawkins right away for Peyton Watson? Peyton Watson, really good defender, athletic, and shown that he's a more polished scorer last year, of course. But I feel like Hawkins is a lot more established of a young player. And to me, that would just be too much, too expensive if I'm bringing in Watson. But the Milwaukee Bucks, they can go in a lot of different directions. And I would try to get New Orleans on the phone and try to get some of their pick protections back. When you look at their pick going to the New Orleans Pelicans and the Atlanta Hawks, also in talks about the Milwaukee pick this upcoming draft. I would try to get on the phone with them, because both of those teams seem to me that they want veteran guys, or at least some of the veterans on the Milwaukee Bucks feel like they would fit nicely. Miles Turner on the Atlanta Hawks as a guy who can shoot the three fits similarly to Okongwu. And also when you look at the New Orleans Pelicans, I don't know what they're doing. The Pelicans in their offseason, they brought everybody back and they haven't really made any moves to speak of. But you could see Joe Dumars and Jamal Mosley, they're trying to win games. And with their young roster, certainly they're going to try to beef up and get more defensive guys next to Derek Queen and Jeremiah Fears. So do they? Those are the first calls I make, is to try to get back some of their next year's pick with New Orleans and Atlanta.
For what it's worth, Peyton Watson for AJ Green would work today. So that's just something to keep in mind there, Tom. I like that idea a lot. Number 28 on my NBA entertainment rankings is the Sacramento Kings. This offseason, they lose Devin Carter, DeMar DeRozan. So far, Russell Westbrook is left not signed. Killian Hayes, my guy. Unfortunately, he's my guy. Gone so far. They draft Darius Acuff with the 7th pick. Caravan at 29. Emmanuel Charbonnet of Houston with the 45th pick. And they haven't done a lot else, the Sacramento Kings. So you look at their rotation this upcoming year. Sabonis is still there. Zach LaVine is still there. DeAndre Hunter, who they brought in last season, is still there. And they get a bunch of young guys other than that. Keegan Murray, still there. Darius Acuff. Malik Monk is coming off the bench next to Nick Clifford. Maxime Reyneau. Dylan Cardwell, who was a fantasy basketball hero down the stretch of last season. Double-double guy basically every night. Alex Caravan, Achiuwa, Sharp. The Kings are not going to be a good team. They're probably going to be the worst team in the Western Conference this year. But number one reason to watch the Sacramento Kings has got to be Darius Acuff, man. This guy is box office. He's a bucket getter through and through. And I think if there's anything on this Kings team that gives them hope, as good as I think Reyneau and Caravan and Clifford and Murray, those young guys are, those are solid young players. None of them have star upside, face of the franchise upside. And that's what Darius Acuff can actually provide to Kings fans who are at a low. At this point, they're at a clear low after experiencing the Light the Beam Kings a few years back. That feels like a lifetime ago at this point. But Acuff can give you that feeling of hope again. And I'm really, you know, fingers crossed. I hope he works out. I want Kings fans to experience that joy again. But that's the number one reason to watch. What does Darius Acuff look like for the Sacramento Kings?
Yeah. And I said on our draft show, over the in June, when I saw this pick, I was like, I feel great for the Kings fans. They have something to root for, because the last couple years have been brutal for Kings fans watching the Light the Beam, Mike Brown, De'Aaron Fox, Keegan Murray's rookie season when he looked like a legit 3-and-D superstar. And everything's kind of fallen apart since. But Acuff, he is electric, and he had a really tough summer league. But the comps to, I mean, people made the comps to Allen Iverson, Damian Lillard. Those are probably the 100th percentile ceiling for Darius Acuff. But let's be honest, at 185 pounds soaking wet, it's going to be a rough year for them, even if he is a 20-point scorer out of the gate. Yep. Just the defense alone, it's going to be really tough for the Kings to stay afloat and be just being able to stay afloat defensively. I just don't see how this team is built to do that with Domantas Sabonis having a lost year with the knee injury. I think it's all about Acuff. It really is. I think they're turning the page on this era, and they're going to try to get whatever they can get for Zach LaVine and Domantas Sabonis at this point. Sabonis, with the meniscus injury that he could not shake last year, even when he was on the floor, the Sacramento Kings got off to a 2-9 start with him on the floor last season early on, and then finished the season 3-16 in the 19 games that Sabonis played. So even if they have Sabonis, I don't think that Doug Christie's squad is going to be able to get out of the basement next season. And in yesterday's big number pod, I actually, man, I feel really bad saying this out loud. And what I actually did was taking the under on 21.5 on the Sacramento Kings. Cause I think Acuff is going to shoot 20 times a game. And I just don't see how they're going to defend at all next year. And I just think 21 and a half is even too optimistic for this squad. I think it's going to be a rough rookie season, and they're going to try to get back into the lottery next year, win the lottery next year. I just don't see it. It's going to be the A-cuffs, the A-cuff show next year. And I don't necessarily think that's going to translate to a lot of wins.
Boy, the under, you said 21 wins is their over under, Tom?
Yeah.
The under, yeah. Oh boy, that's disgusting. I mean, what's especially disgusting for the Sacramento Kings taking the under with that is the fact that some of the other worst teams in the NBA don't have their own picks. So that means you're saying the Kings are going to be worse than Brooklyn, who don't have their own pick. The Houston Rockets have it. They're going to be worse than the Milwaukee Bucks, who don't have their own pick. The New Orleans Pelicans have it. But that's what's going to make this upcoming season so fascinating with the draft relegation zone at the bottom. And just to tie this to a question from Don J on the Spotify comments, Don asked about, he doesn't understand why, if the Nets pick is number one in 2027, why they can't pick first again in 2028. And that's because of these new draft lottery rules. With the new draft lottery rules, the teams that finish with one of the three worst records, for what it's worth, they're in a draft relegation zone, okay? So they get one less lottery ball than the next seven worst teams. So that's one factor to think about. But whoever lands the first pick, if this year the Washington Wizards can't be number one in 2027 because they were number one in 2026 this year, taking AJ DiBonsa. The new rules aren't allowing teams to draft first in consecutive years. And so that's why. So if the Nets end up with the number one pick in 2027, that means they can't pick first in 2028. And that applies only to your own team. And so if the Pelicans get the first pick this year, but it's because of the Bucks pick, the Pelicans' own first-round draft pick can end up first in 2028. So just making that clear for Don Jay in the Spotify comments and anybody else confused on that new draft lottery rule. But the new big draft lottery rule that's going to really affect the whole league is the draft relegation zone, where the bottom three teams get one less lottery ball than the teams with the fourth to the 10th worst records. The bottom three get two lottery balls. Teams 4 to 10 get three lottery balls. Teams 11 to 14 get two lottery balls. And teams 15 and 16 get one lottery ball. Those are the winners of the play-in tournament. So 16 teams are going to be in the draft lottery this year. The Kings, you taking the under, Tom. You're suggesting that the Kings, despite all their efforts to battle out of the draft relegation zone, to get out, to get the best draft lottery odds, that they're not going to be able to do it. Yeah. That's how bad you think the Kings are going to be this year, in part because of how stacked the Western Conference is. And I think maybe in that sense, having the Kings 28th on my rankings is far too low. Maybe they should be significantly higher through this lens. Because can this team fight out of the draft relegation zone? Are they going to be one of the most watchable teams in March and April when they're trying to win every night, doing everything possible? They make a trade at the deadline in February to try to win, to get 25 wins instead of 20. Because you think they're going to be the under. So I do think that's going to be really interesting this entire NBA season and how teams approach it with the standings.
Yeah, and one thing I'll add is that the Memphis Grizzlies are pretty upset because they traded for the Utah Jazz pick.
Yes.
And that actually, under the rules, they can't get a top five pick out of the Utah Jazz if it falls in the top five, because the Utah Jazz have already been in the top five the previous 2 years with Ace Bailey and, of course, Darren Peterson last year. So it is very complicated that the fact that the Memphis Grizzlies get penalized for trading for a pick in the previous iteration of the draft reform, and they get penalized if that becomes a top five pick, they would not be able to get that pick from Utah in the case that it falls in the top five. But it's a lot has to do with the competency that I've seen from Doug Christie as a head coach. Is that, can he actually squeeze out more wins than this roster suggests? It also is baking in the possibility that Zach LaVine, he's not healthy enough to show that he's going to be a help to a contender, and they're not going to be able to move him for a lot of good assets, young assets. And I just think that Domantas Sabonis, I need to see how his body looks going into the season. He's never been a good defender. And I think this is going to be the worst defense in the NBA next season. And I just think that Darius Acuff, I think he's just going to shoot. He has every reason to be the focal point of this organization next year. And plenty of guys have been inefficient and been basement dwellers their first year. I think of KD on the Sonics, where it's just like they gave him the rock. They played him in a lot of different positions. They were an awful team. Didn't stop him becoming a first ballot Hall of Famer. But the first year is probably going to be pretty rough in Sacramento. And on top of that, a lot of these bad teams are not going to have their first round pick and not going to have any incentive to tank. And so that leaves us with the Sacramento Kings.
Tom, last Thursday you mentioned you had your weekend with your buddies, your in-person fantasy football draft. How'd it go? Who'd you take first?
Yeah, so I had the eighth pick. The way we do this is we have a draft of the draft. So in reverse order, if you were the 12th team in the standings, you get the first pick of what draft slot you want. And by virtue of me winning the league and getting the championship, I had the whatever was left over in the draft of the draft, which meant the eighth pick. So interestingly enough, the number one guy off the board PPR league in a 12-team league, Puka Nacua, went number one in this draft. And so I ended up at the eighth slot. I got ASB. With the eighth slot, got a wide receiver that could be the best wide receiver in the league. And I've had him a couple years over the last 5 years. I ended up going him at eight, Omarion Hampton at 17. Ladd McConkey might have been a little bit of a reach, but I like him in the McDaniels offense, stacking those two guys. T. Higgins in the fourth round. Carnell Tate, Rook, I got him at 56. Chuba Hubbard, Josh Downs. And the two guys that I kept as the as the 11th and 12th round, I got Rico Dowdle at the 11th round, and I got Manungai at the 12th round. So I was able to stack a lot of wide receivers early, but I really like my roster. My quarterback is Caleb Williams. So some high ceiling guys on my team with a lot of first and second year guys, but I'm pretty happy with it. Yahoo gave me a B+ on my draft. I'm feeling pretty good about things. Second place. And we know the Yahoo draft grades are set in stone. It's marble. So I got a pretty good grade, and the projections say I'm going to finish like 11-3. So I'm feeling pretty good about things, Kev. What do you think?
I'm just glad you didn't take Ricky Pearsall with your early draft. Out for the season again. I watched a great video from our Yahoo Fantasy NFL YouTube page. It was like a YouTube short the other day about, I still believe in Ricky Pearsall. I still believe. And then 2 days later, season-ending PCL injury, out for the year. Pearsall just can't seem to stay healthy in San Francisco, unfortunately. I'm looking forward to the 49ers-Rams game in Melbourne, Australia. There's the controversy this week about their travel plans. The Rams are arriving in Australia the day before the week one matchup against the Niners, and the Niners are spending a full week there. What are your thoughts on that, Tom? Who's taking the right approach? Is it the Rams or the 49ers?
The 49ers. I think get away from the power station, the substation, and make sure you're getting there.
Well, that's a good reason. That's a good reason.
Get there early, spend as much time of the season, not at
get
home.
Away from the power station. That's a great reason.
Have you gotten on a flight like that to Australia
that? I've only been out of the country. I've only been to Montreal and Toronto.
Okay, so this is shocking to me that the Rams are planning to be the day before maybe these planes that the players, the NFL guys are on, it's not the same that I went on Qantas Airlines when I was in high school when I flew to Brisbane. But this feels like, to me, the right call for the 49ers. And it's a Thursday night matchup. I picked up Stafford just as a flyer, as my QB2 in case he goes off in that Thursday night game. And then if he doesn't do well, then I can waive him. But I feel much better about the 49ers setup. It seems insane to me that they would want to do that, but I guess they feel fine about that cross the globe travel going into that. And so they don't have to reacclimate their bodies coming back from Australia, I guess would be the upside.
I think the Rams are making very clearly the right choice, in my opinion. And for two reasons. One, last year. Well, three reasons. One, last year they did the London trip and they did the same exact thing. They went 35-7 against the Jags. They did this. They just didn't adjust their bodies. They stayed on their West Coast time for their game in London. This year, going to Melbourne, different experience, longer flight as well, 15-hour flight. That's a lot to do a day before a game. I get that. But I think in their bodies, for their bodies, this is going to be a 5:30 Pacific Coast time game. It's played at 10:30 a.m. local in Australia. To me, spending a full week there, adjusting your sleep schedule and all that, it's pointless when you have an out-of-the-ordinary 10:30 a.m. start time. Why do I want to adjust to waking up every morning at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 8 a.m. in Australia time and then have to get ready for a 10:30 a.m. game? That's unusual. That's weird for your body. I'd rather time my flight and wake up in the wee hours of the morning, 2 a.m. wake-up call time, whatever it is, in Australia, and go through your day normally. Like just time-wise in terms of preparing for a 10:30 a.m. local start game when it's 5:30 p.m. in your body. So that's the way I look at it. Anytime I have, personally, I'm not an athlete, I'm not playing a full NFL game, but when I have short trips, I never adjust my sleep schedule, ever. If I'm going east to west for a night or two, I'll wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning. And I'm going to go to bed at 8:30 at night. I don't adjust. I don't try to adjust. I just stay on it because then it doesn't affect me when I go back for the next however many months before my next trip. And I think the Rams are probably thinking the same thing. Why put all this effort into one game that could therefore then affect us for the weeks to come?
The Rams are playing on Monday Night Football after they have an extra day of rest coming into the next season. They're playing the Giants on Monday Night Football after this Australia game. And the 49ers are playing Sunday at home that following week. So you would think that it would be the opposite, is that the 49ers would want to adjust and make sure, or not adjust, and then come back because they got a game on Sunday after that Thursday night game in Australia. But it's the opposite. So I don't know. The Rams already have a built-in extra day in the schedule to reacclimate to Pacific Coast time. So I don't know. We'll have a little steak dinner or whatever you want on it. I'll take the 49ers against the spread on that in that Thursday matchup. And if you take the other side of that, we'll do a steak dinner or something like that in that first week matchup. Do you think?
Yeah, sure. I'll take the Rams 3.5. They're 3.5, minus 3.5 against the Niners. I'll take the Rams to win that game, minus 3.5. So we get a bet, Tom. So you're 49ers up money line? Plus 3.5, Rams minus 3.5.
Okay.
I'll take it.
Okay.
The 49ers are also just battered, like just so many injuries already because of the power station. What if there's something to that, Tom? What if there is?
Man, I mean, I had the opportunity of drafting Kittle or Mark Andrews, and I just wanted nothing to do with Kittle coming back from that injury. It's going to be a while before he's back to form, but yeah, Achilles tear, the station, all that stuff. I know we're not scientific about this on this show, on an NBA show, but I stayed away from the 49ers on that front. So I'm very happy with my team. I'm especially excited for Manungai. Hopefully he's healthy. He missed a couple of days, but look, man, getting two running backs like that, who can be the lead running back if things shake out right at the 11th round and the 12th round, I'm feeling pretty good about that. The really crazy thing is we did a draft a month before, you know, the training camps and preseason gets going. So a lot can change between now and the season. This is by far the earliest draft I've ever done. So might be a little nutty to do that at the end of July like we did.
It's too early. Way too early for a draft, Tom. But your team seems good. I hope you go back-to-back. And I look forward to steak dinner on your tab.
Wow.
Looking forward to it, Tom. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today, man. Glad you're starting to feel better. Congrats on the draft. Always good to talk basketball with you, man. We'll be right back. All right, joining me now from 99 The Fan, it's Adam Gold. Adam, you've been covering Tom Dunn and the Carolina Hurricanes for a long time now, and now in the NBA, everybody's focused on what's happening with the Portland Trailblazers, now owned by Tom Dundon. So I'm curious, with your time covering the Canes, with how things began with Dundon, what similarities are you seeing between Dundon's early ownership with the Hurricanes versus the Blazers?
I think the best way to answer that is that there are two Tom Dundons. There's not one. There's two Tom Dundons. There is an owner of the team, Tom Dundon. And we're talking about the team on the court for the Hurricanes, the team on the ice, and everything that impacts that team, Tom has been absolutely incredible at. He hasn't made every decision correctly. You're never going to do that. But they had a plan when they came in. They stuck to that plan. And it culminated in winning a Stanley Cup last year. But the truth is they've been a legitimate Stanley Cup contender now for like 4 years. And this was a team that didn't make the playoffs for 9 consecutive years prior to him assuming full ownership. So there's that Tom Dundon. Then there is the other Tom Dundon that I feel like the Blazers and the NBA establishment are dealing with. And that's not the good Tom Dundon. That is the Tom Dundon that, you know, became a billionaire on the backs of, you know, kind of, you know, less fortunate people that doesn't have much empathy towards others. That is very much, what is the bottom line? That's big business, Tom Dundon. And he's been incredibly successful doing that. The broadcast part, I mean, that's par for the course here. One of the first things he did was eliminate the radio broadcast of a Hockey Hall of Famer. Chuck Caton is in the broadcasting wing of the Hockey Hall of Fame, still on that committee. He had spent 39 years with the Whalers and Hurricanes franchise, called every game that they had done, and including the Stanley Cup in 2006, was part of the team in 2009 when they went to the conference final. And his last season was the 17-18 season, the year Tom Dundon assumed ownership midstream. And then they dumped the broadcast, incredibly popular, you know, personality. And I'm friends with Chuck to this day. The radio booth was named for him at Lenovo Center now. And then they had John Forslund, who is, I mean, to me, the best hockey voice that there is. They had him on radio. I mean, this franchise had both Chuck Caton and John Forslund, who I think should go into the Hockey Hall of Fame too. They had them both. And Forslund did a radio simulcast for basically, you know, 2 years, but his contract was up the following year and they got into a major dispute. John is still not over it. And they basically let John go because Tom Dundon doesn't see value in things that do not directly add to winning. So simulcasting TV, radio in, you know, for the Blazers, that was always going to happen. And he's going to go as cheap as he can on the things that do not impact winning. And everything that you have seen him do with Portland is with that mindset, whether it's the two-way contract players during the playoffs or team employees not getting what they had been getting before, and whether that's going to be effective. And the NBA and the NHL, two very different leagues, I would point out, in terms of one is flush with cash and the other is definitely getting better thanks to Gary Bettman, but it's not the same. And I think it's going to be more of a culture shock for Blazers fans than anything else.
It was amazing looking up at the beginning of Tom Dundon's era as owner of the Hurricanes. And I found an article you wrote in 2018 about the letting go of Chuck Caton. And you wrote, that doesn't make it any easier for fans, colleagues of the team who will certainly have to deal with another public relations shot to the solar plexus, from the prolonged and messy firing of general manager Ron Francis to the very public struggles to find a replacement. This has been a rocky spring for the organization. And you go on to talk about the emotional loss of Caton. And it is so much like what's happening in Portland right now, with they lose Kevin Calabro, who called it a subprime offer for the contract extension offer he got. Very well done by Calabro. Very good. Yeah. So it's very much like losing him. It's also, the Hurricanes lost their general manager. The Blazers lost their head coach, Tiago Splitter, who left for the Chicago Bulls. They bring in a new head coach on a very odd, non-guaranteed year two, year three contract type of contract, which is unusual in the NBA. So for Blazers fans, they're experiencing the same type of thing. And I think for Portland, now dealing with this arena deal, that also is very much like what happened with the Canes in the early days. Carolina, correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, when Dundon took over, there was a dispute over the arena at that time. The difference was that he bought the Canes with the understanding that he would keep the team in Carolina, whereas that guarantee was not there in Portland.
Well, I don't know if there was a guarantee that he would keep the Hurricanes here. I think he said all the right things, but I have spoken to Tom about this. By the way, for the people who cover the Blazers, and I don't know if he'll be different in the NBA than he was for me in the NHL, but Tom is fine with you criticizing him. He will not hold a grudge. I've had a very open communication with Dundon from the moment he got here. So he's been, in that respect, a good owner, even though he will, I'll just, use air quotes here, forget what he told you, and then later on pretend he told you something else. And I'm like, no. You told me. My source is you. So we're not going to dispute what I just said when you're the source. Anyway, but I don't think there was a guarantee he was going to stay. In fact, my understanding is that when he bought the Hurricanes, his intent was to move them because he didn't think it would work out. He saw a depressed asset, which is what he does. So when he bought the Hurricanes, I think he was like, I don't think we're going to make it here. And he knew he could move them to Houston, possibly, or Austin. He doesn't realize how hard it is to relocate a franchise in the NHL, especially one where the commissioner values the market. And Gary Bettman does value Raleigh, North Carolina. And he once asked me, well, how fast do you think we can get fans back here? I said, Tom, it took a long time for the fans to leave. When you start winning, the fans will come back quickly. I didn't think they would come back year one. I thought it would be a little bit of a lead. I thought it would take year two. But it came back year one because they got red hot in the second half of the year, made the playoffs. We know what happened. They went to the Stanley Cup, to the Eastern Conference Finals. And they were a sellout throughout the playoffs, and is still the best building in the league as far as I'm concerned. But he hired the right coach, even though he will forget that he didn't really want to hire Rod Brind'Amour. He wanted to hire, I don't know who he wanted to hire, but he wanted somebody with experience. The problem was he wasn't offering money for somebody with experience to take the job, just like he couldn't get an actual GM. So he simply took a former GM, Don Waddell, who was acting as the team's president, really running the business side of things, and he just gave him another title, and he made him the GM too, because he couldn't convince other GMs to work for the lowest contract for a general manager in the league, on top of the fact that he didn't want to give that GM a contract. And that's by rule, you have to do that in the NHL. And Rod Brind'Amour, for the first 3 years, was the lowest paid coach in the league. And even after the success he had for 3 years, was probably bottom third of the head coaches in the league. He's still, I don't even think he's in the top half of the highest paid coaches in the league. He's the best coach in the NHL. I'll fight anybody over that. There's nobody in this league who's a better coach than Rob Brindamore. And he's the best thing. He's the face of the franchise, even though Carolina's got some pretty great players. But just Dundon, this is just the pattern with him. He's going to upset people, but he ultimately understands that all fans care about is winning. So the Chuck Caton thing, it was upsetting for a lot of people, but the team won. The John Forslund thing was upsetting for a lot of people, but the team won. And as long as the team wins, fans will come. The arena deal, I mean, I hate the fact, this is not Dundon. This is any owner. I hate asking the public who are going to pay tickets, pay for tickets, and pay for parking and pay for concessions. I hate asking the public to basically finance your playground. I don't think it's right. We have too many things that government needs to do, needs to provide for, let alone, you know, do your building. But, you know, what I think and what the reality is two completely different things, because that's the way the thing is, things are done in professional sports. They feel like they've got leverage. They can move the team. And I think he would love to move the team if he can't get everything he wants from Portland. But maybe he'll screw up and they'll win. And that's a great city, we know, for NBA basketball. And if they win, he can't move them.
You mentioned the arena deal in Carolina. He eventually got the $300 million in public arena funding that he was asking for, and they signed the 20-year lease extension as a result of getting that public funding. And he also committed $200 million over 5 years and $800 million over 20 years of private spending to build an entertainment district with restaurants, apartments, hotels. Has that happened?
Well, I mean, they just agreed to that deal about a year and a half ago. But that's a deal that really has been set in place. That money's been there. We have it's called the Centennial Authority, and they essentially own the building. It's a weird relationship, but everything is done through the Centennial Authority. But that money has been there. It just has to be allocated. There have been hotel and restaurant taxes, to help finance that forever. The arena renovations were going to be first, and then they will start an entertainment district. Heck, who knows down the road if that even gets modified to include a baseball stadium. Personally, I'd rather see a soccer specific facility, because I don't think Major League Baseball, I don't think Raleigh can handle all of these things. We're a small town city type deal. I mean, we're top 25 media market, but because the two big colleges are located here, it's really like having five big league franchises, because basketball and football at both universities tap into the local, business community. And there's just not that much money to go around where we can also support Major League Baseball. I think Major League Soccer has a chance. Yeah, I'd love to see a new stadium for our women's NWSL team, which frankly is playing in a substandard facility for professional soccer. And I'd love to see a soccer stadium be part of this entertainment district, but there's going to be hotels and residences and green spaces and a music venue. It's going to be great when it's done, but we're probably, 10 years away from seeing even a phase of it completed. But the land is set aside and the plans are made. And, you know, essentially he's going to do that, you know, because he's going to reap all the benefits of it. So there'll be some construction and some infrastructure that has to happen from the city side, but I think he's going to do that, and more power to him, but he's also going to reap all the benefits of it.
Now, Blazers fans are obviously scared right now that they could actually move.
If they don't win, you should be.
they should be, for sure. Now, if they stay, there are some benefits potentially with having Tom Dundon as your owner. Like you said, he's invested in winning. He's willing to spend on what it takes to win. How has that manifested for him with the Hurricanes? Why does his approach work when it leads to what happens on the ice and on the court and basketball?
I don't know if what he's done in hockey is translatable to basketball, though. I think that the core of the two sports is very different. In the NHL, you can win without superstar caliber players. You can't. The Hurricanes are proof of that. NHL.com just put forth their top 250 fantasy hockey players. We all know fantasy is just about like offensive production, basically. And the best Hurricane offensive player was ranked 96th.
That's coming off a cup.
We don't have, yeah, 96th. Now, goalies are in there, too. The top Hurricane player was a goalie, Brandon Bussey, who last year they picked off of waivers 4 days before the start of the regular season because they knew they needed a backup goalie. That's going to be Carolina's game one starter, which is amazing. And he won the Stanley Cup last year, which is even more amazing. But in the NBA, man, you got to have stars. And in the NBA, you can throw your draft picks down, you know, away to bring a star in. We see it routinely. Heck, the Knicks traded 4 first round picks for Miles Bridges, which whatever. But you can't do that. They don't do that in hockey. And he will value those draft picks. They are more likely to sell players for draft picks than trade a bunch of draft picks away for star players. So I don't know how the build is going to go. But I will tell you this. In hockey, this was his pattern. And whether he recognized that he could do it here or not, he's a smart guy. He will hire good people that understand the, you know, where you can work the margins to your advantage. And he's very into the data and analytics. I'll tell you a story in a second about that. But they came in, they decided they were going to put values on players, those who help winning, almost a money ball kind of impact. And they weren't going to deviate from that. They weren't going to get emotional about it. They don't do trade deadline really at all. Very, very little. They did it once. It didn't work. And I asked him, are you more inclined to do it again? He goes, nope, I'll never do it again. and I'm not saying they won't, because he has changed a little bit, because I think he is getting somewhat emotional about it. But they have a plan and they have stuck to it. And that is the hardest thing to do when you are an owner and you are competitive, is because there are outside forces that force you to do things you don't want to do because you think you're supposed to do it. He does not play that. Just because the NHL has done things as a rule doesn't mean he will. I think you'll see the same thing in the NBA, as opposed to the reference to data. I asked him about, you know, this is before he made the trade. You may not know Jake Guentzel came from Pittsburgh to Carolina and then ultimately signed with Tampa in the offseason. That was a deal that Carolina screwed up. He wanted to stay with the Hurricanes, but they lowballed him an offer enough to where he goes, well, let me just look around, and he got a better deal from Tampa. But I asked him if because that was his first trade deadline, we're going to see if we can add and go for it. That was the first time he had done that. I asked him if he was more likely to do it again. He goes, I'm not going to do anything that only increases my chances of winning by 1 or 2%. That doesn't work it for me. That's the way he thinks. We add a player, does he increase our chances of winning? They've got a formula. And he said, for 1 or 2%, never going to do it again. Unless it's something that we have to have, which they have done in the past, but that isn't a trade deadline move to me.
This all led to winning the Stanley Cup this year. They have second best record in the NHL since he took over as owner behind the Colorado Avalanche. And it's basically equal in points and in total wins. All that said, they win the cup, and you look at the Stanley Cup engraved in the first two lines of the Stanley Cup this year is Dundon. Just the whole family.
Yeah.
The first two lines are all Tom Dundon's family, and that left off some members of the Carolina staff. What has been the reaction locally to that happening?
Tom Dundon is a very calculated guy. He understands that there's going to be pushback initially. People aren't talking about it now. So I mean, it's the news cycle. The news people will forget. And when the team takes the ice on September 29th against the Florida Panthers in the opener, and they raise the Stanley Cup banner, and the cup is in the house, and everybody gets their rings, and there's 19,000 Caniacs in the building, they won't care. They won't remember that it's Dundon, 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 Dundon on the first line of the cup. They won't. It's. I wish we were more like elephants and less like goldfish, but we're not. People are not. So it's again, people will forget. The news cycle moves on, and Dundon doesn't care. He doesn't.
Have you talked to him about Portland at all? Where do you think he would bring the team? Have you talked to him about that at all, if he did decide to move?
I really haven't talked to him much about Portland, other than like throughout the process. I wanted to talk to him about it, but before it became official, he really wasn't allowed to say much about it. But I have been talking with him on and off. Here's all I can say is, because I don't really know what his plan. He hasn't told me his plans, but we haven't really gotten into Portland. But I could tell you from my own experience, and this is after the fact, he never talked about moving the team publicly when he was here, when he first took over. But I did ask him about it in our conversation. I guess it was right at the beginning of the Stanley Cup final. He was on the show, and we talked about the impact of Rod Brind'Amour. And, you know, Rod, first of all, franchise legend. He was already an established great player in Philadelphia at the time Jim Rutherford made the trade to bring him to Carolina back in 2000. And then decided to stay, won a cup, and now as the coach, won another cup. But, I mean, they're going to name streets for parts of highways for Rod Brind'Amour when it's all done. There'll be statues, and a lot of kids will be named Rod in Raleigh. And we talked about the impact of Brind'Amour, and a lot of people talked about it in hockey terms where they said, well, you know, none of this is possible without Rod. And I said to Tom, I said, I know people are talking about hockey, but I said, I don't think any of this, meaning the Hurricanes still being here, is possible without Rod. And he agreed. So he took me back in his own mind, back at the beginning of this journey with the Hurricanes. And if it didn't turn around, because attendance wasn't great, the business community wasn't great, and because it had been, you know, a while where the franchise had atrophied, it was a poor franchise. Peter Karmanos, the old owner, had no money. They spent no money. They were at the floor of the salary cap basically every year. And they haven't been. They've been a cap team since Dundon has taken over, basically. But he told me in retrospect, yeah. He wasn't sure it was going to survive in Raleigh, and he was willing and ready to move. So that's why I say, if you're a Blazers fan, yeah, I think there is reason to worry that your team is going to leave. But he's such a smart owner that if they can turn it around, I mean, he'll figure out a way to turn it around. In which case, we know what the market is. We know how it embraces the Blazers. And as long as they win, I think everything will work out really well in Portland. And I trust Tom to do that, because his track record here, I know it's just one for one, but his track record here is pretty awesome. Well, I shouldn't say one for one. Whatever football league he bought, they shut that down in a hurry. But that was never going to work anyway. That football league was terrible.
Like you said, just because it worked in the NHL doesn't mean that same philosophy will apply to the NBA. Different leagues, different approaches, and we'll see how it plays out.
Completely different.
Exactly. And so I think August 12th is the first really sign of what's going to happen with Moda Center in Portland, when the Portland City Council is going to vote on a term sheet for the proposed nearly $600 million renovation. So August 12th, next Tuesday, that's the big date. Last thing I want to ask you about, Adam, Duke, Joaquin Boumsheh. Are people excited locally for the incoming freshman? You're going to get 2 years. 2 years of Boumsheh going to Duke. Could be the number one pick in the 2028 NBA draft, because we're going to see a lot of him at Duke.
I mean, every year. John Shire is a rock star, man. The ability to attract this kind of talent year over year over year is just incredible. He's got some coaching chops that need to get honed. I think they probably are better positioned at point guard this year than they have been in the past. The one thing they haven't had is a great point guard, which has hurt them down the stretch in games. That's how you lose to Houston when you lead by 14. That's how you lose to Connecticut when you lead by double digits. Caden Boozer has a better final possession, Duke wins that game and gets to another Final Four. But he panicked. All he has to do is hold. You don't have to do anything. Just hold the ball. Just grab it. They're going to put you at the free throw line. Because they had to, but that's not what happened. Anyway, we're excited about Boumsheh. We're excited about Williams, Rippey. They're so, so good. And I've known John a long time. I covered him as a player. I talked to him when he was playing professionally in Israel. Chris Carwell is a friend, the assistant coach. I know how they're run. It is awesome. Duke's always fun to watch. They're America's basketball team, America's college basketball team. They're Notre Dame football. They're the Yankees. some people hate the Yankees. I hate the Yankees, actually. But I don't hate Duke basketball. I love Duke basketball to death. It's a great program.
North Carolina could be pretty good, too, with Malone there now, too. Michael Malone. Don't call him Mike. That's just a little tip. Don't call him Mike Malone. It's Michael. It's Michael Malone. I don't know if he's made that clear already.
I'm not 100% sure the roster's great.
It's not.
But
I like Matt Abel. Got the transfer from NC State. Matt Abel's good.
He was a very good player. I thought Matt Abel was going to be a star last year. Just didn't quite, find a groove. I mean, that might have been Will Wade's problem more than Matt Abel's problem. I think they've got some good players. I just don't know how good everybody is and how everybody fits. College basketball here isn't boring. I think State's going to be pretty good. I like the fact that they brought an alum back that cares about the program, not a mercenary, because that's what Will Wade was. He was just a mercenary. But he had the ability to fool everybody, which is why a lot of people thought, oh, man, Will Wade, that's going to be great. Yeah, it was not good. He checked out on that team early. Like, he knew what he was going to do at the end of the year. It's going to be a fun year. I cannot wait for college basketball, but I got hockey stuff to deal with. That's going to be, because that's really what I do. I cover the hockey team. I talk about hoops and football all the time, but my beat is the Hurricanes. And I made that decision a long time ago to attach myself to professional athletes who are much, much easier to deal with. Not the athletes, the people around the athletes. I hate dealing with schools. Hey, give me pros. Give me pros all day long. Much better.
Yeah, that is for sure. True in the NBA compared to college basketball as well. Adam, thank you so much for joining me today. Have a good day, man. Thank you. Thanks to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's episode. Thanks to the live YouTube chat as well for watching us live and commenting. Please be sure to subscribe to @YahooSportsNBA if you have not done so already, and subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good weekend, everybody. Talk to you on Monday.